Item 16, Columbia River Spring Chinook Recreational Fisheries from 2013 to 2017 review, and this is a briefing. Bill? So we welcome Bill in a new role.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Would it be appropriate at this time if I give the commission, this was a request that came from me.
Yes.
And I could probably provide a bit of background why I requested this.
Certainly, Commissioner Grable.
For this presentation.
Yes.
What we're going to talk about is the spring salmon of hope. Thank you. The spring salmon allotment and catch balancing. This first got my attention back in 2014 through an article that was in Salmon Trout Steelheader. And I think I've distributed this to all of the commission members and some staff. This article detailed the process. I'm not suggesting that I agree with the conclusions that are included in this article, but this was my first introduction to this issue, and I've been encouraged since then to follow up, and this is the beginning of that process. One of the things that I would like to see is I wanted the commission to start on the same page with this. At the same time, so we all have the same information, and then I'm going to encourage the department to review this with input from the other regions, Upper Columbia regions, because I believe there's new information. For example, the releases of spring salmon from the Colville hatchery up in our region, for example, to be included in how this is formulated. And then as a next step, and we all, by the way, we've received letters from county commissioners and cities in the Mid-Columbia region asking for this same review because they feel it's inequitable and important to their economies that they share in the availability of spring salmon. And so we'll hear about that today. And then as a follow-up, it's interesting that in 2006, Mr. Twite and Heather Bartlett presented at the Douglas County PUD the Upper Columbia Fish Management Plan at that time. And it was exciting in that it was a top-down approach to Columbia River fisheries management. It assured that the escapement goals were met at the home streams and then worked its way downstream. And eventually what I would hope to see, and I'm requesting, is that part of this review of the spring salmon allotment and catch balancing be incorporated into this plan for the Upper Columbia to mesh with the Lower Columbia so that we have a refreshed view of the Columbia River management plan that includes new and updated information. And that's, I just wanted to make that statement, and I'm very pleased that Bill Twite has taken on the task of presenting this today.
Thank you, Commissioner Grable. I think we have a new definition for top-down when it applies to fishing. So, go ahead, Phil, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioners. Thank you, Commissioner Grable, for the intro and laying a fairly high expectation on my presentation. I agree with Commissioner Grable that the Upper Columbia is indeed the top of the world and that everything should flow down from that. Forgive me, my cozying up to Commissioner Grable there. So what I'd like to do with today's presentation is first start with just a general orientation, largely centered around policy C-3620 that's been in effect now for 5 years. That you all, I think many of you remember well from the battle scars you gained during the formulation of that. Then focus some on spring Chinook, in particular the recreational allocations. Also provide some context for that by taking a quick look at some of the other species that were covered by that same policy, because when you adopted the policy, you didn't do it on a single species basis. Even though we're focusing on spring Chinook here, the choices you made around spring Chinook allocation were made within the context of the others and trying to think about what really constitutes a year-round cross-species recreational fishery in each of those areas. And so we thought it was appropriate to give you some of that context as well. Commissioner Graybill mentioned some of the constituency letters that we've received recently. I'll give you an overview of those and of the combined agency commission response to those. Give you some additional overview of the Upper Columbia Harvest Framework, which is still a draft, but has been used. And then finally, if there's still time, just give you some insight into some changes we've made internally in the department that I think will help both the department, but also you and stakeholders sort of have kind of one-stop shopping for Columbia River issues, Columbia River fishery management and hydro management issues. So with that, some background on first spring Chinook, and I think you all are pretty well aware of all these, but it's there's a multi-layer world that we deal with when we're thinking about spring Chinook, and it starts with ESA as well as the other conservation, the basic conservation objectives that we have. USV Oregon is overarching for it as well. That's the treaty tribal arrangement. Washington and the Washington Commission policy is also a major document relative to how we manage spring Chinook throughout the Columbia. There is as well, though it's not mentioned on this slide, but there is as well an agreement with the Caldwell tribes about how we'll manage the spring Chinook that return to their waters as part of the non-treaty share. I'm not going to focus much on that today, but just that is one more piece of what we deal with. And then we talk, when we're thinking about spring Chinook, we talk in general about the two primary ESA-listed components. That's where we're often focusing. Both the Upper Columbia Springs and the Snake River Springs are ESA are ESA-listed populations with separate objectives, separate biological opinions, and to some extent then that governs how we do things within the state of Washington. The commission's policy C-3620, starts as does everything else with conservation as the fundamental priority, but it provides us with extensive guidance on fishery allocations, both the basic sport commercial allocation of the non-treaty share, again setting aside the Caldwell allocation, and then provides us with some pretty strong guidance how within the recreational share, how to divvy that up throughout the basin. And part of the commission's objectives were to provide as broad geographic opportunity as possible, recognizing that it is largely a zero-sum game, that as you move spring Chinook out of one fishery and into another, that one fishery pays the price. There are ways of optimizing, but there is no perfect optimal at all. It is a set of trade-offs. You can take advantage of some circumstances to sort of extend geographic opportunity, but largely it's just a question of if you take a little from here to give a little over there, both sides are going to feel it. The other thing I want to just remind you of is that we have about five more years on 3620. It was updated at the end of December 2016, but that for in part. But overall, the policy is valid through 2023. So focusing in a little more closely on upriver spring Chinook, the basic commission policy is to divide the recreational fishery using ESA impacts as the metric, not using actual catch, but using ESA impacts as the metric, upstream and downstream of Bonneville Dam, because that's one of the major sort of dividing points for us for spring Chinook. As I talk about some other species, I'll bring in some other dividing points, but the primary dividing point for spring Chinook has always been above and below Bonneville. There are sub-dividing points, though, and I'll get to that a little bit later. But the basic decision is the 25-75 split of the ESA impacts, and that's primarily, in practice, that's been primarily driven by the Snake River impacts. The Upper Columbia impacts haven't played as much of a role, but it's typically the Snake impacts that we're dividing 25-75. In order to make this work well, staff have gone ahead and divided that 25 a little further to provide 10% to the what we call the Zone 6 fishery or the pools between Bonneville and McNary Dam, and then another 15% to the Snake River, the Washington portion of the Snake River. Without that sort of subsequent staff dividing, it's likely that the Zone 6 fishery would simply have eaten up most of the upriver impacts and not allowed the Snake fishery. That's that 10-15 division has been supported by Oregon staff as well. They've cooperated in achieving that. The other directive that the policy itself provides is a timing one, and that's where I spoke of sort of trying to take advantage of some of the opportunities that just naturally offer themselves. Timing is one of those. Typically, after we're able to get a good fix on the run, catchability of spring Chinook downriver below Bonneville tends to fall off of its own, even though there's still a fair amount of availability. Catchability tends to decrease a bit, as well as sometimes effort. And so it's you directed us to, once we've got that update in place, to put our highest priority on achieving the allocations above Bonneville. And if for some reason the update comes in low, obviously this also provides guidance for us to, at that point, put all of our emphasis into trying to make sure that the above Bonneville fisheries get an opportunity that's somewhat equal to the lower river opportunities. These do conflict some with another aspect of the policy, and that's the 45-day objective for the lower river. That often creates an additional complication for us, and so creates some kind of tension that it can be difficult, and in fact we have not always been able to achieve the 45-day objective in the lower river, well, sometimes simply because of run size and catch, but other times because it's conflicted fairly directly with your directive to put increased emphasis after the run size update as well. It's fine to have those kinds of competing objectives. I'm not saying that should be changed at this point, just calling that to your attention that that is one of the things that the staff often have to balance, is those two different directives. We understand the intent behind both, and those not questioning the intent at all, and obviously in an optimal situation we would be able to address both, so it's worth having both in there, but just it does create in some years at least a source of tension, and typically when that happens we've put more weight on the providing for the sport fishery upstream, because that relates directly to the 75-25, and we take that as basic guidance, the 75-25. There's been a lot of question about a couple of aspects of spring Chinook management, and I'll try to give you a bit of an overview of those. I think a full review of where we're at after 5 years, we'll have to dive in a little more deeply than we were prepared to with this, but I just wanted to give you a bit of a sense. One of them is the concept of the management buffer or the risk buffer. I think you're aware that both through your policy, but also through USV Oregon policy, the fisheries, the non-treaty fisheries, have a 30% buffer, meaning we manage for 70% of the predicted run size prior to the update, and that buffer is divided between the sport and commercial fisheries, with 20% of it being absorbed by the sport fishery, 40% by the commercial fishery. But as we dramatically restructure the commercial fisheries, there simply aren't the number of main stem fisheries to actually provide a 40% buffer. So in order to achieve the 30% overall, we're actually having to buffer the recreational fishery more towards 30% in recent years. And so that hasn't we haven't been able to stick to the 2040 because, again, we regard the 30% as the fundamental, both because that's the USV Oregon obligation, but also that was the fundamental aspect of the commission policy, too. There's been some concern by some Upper River parties, and I'll reference that more later when I talk about the Southeast Washington constituent letters, that the buffers actually worked against them. So far, as we've looked at the data, we haven't been able to find any rationale or any support for that particular concept. We do understand that it may not be providing them all the relief they've been hoping for, and that's something we will dive into a little further and take a look at that part of it. But there is no basis that we can find to a claim that the buffers actually are working against upriver fishing interests. Another issue that a lot of people focus on is the catch balancing provisions that affect how we manage upriver spring chinook, how we affect the manage the non-treaty portion of the upriver spring chinook. The catch balancing is a feature of the last 10-year agreement of USV Oregon, and it will be rolled over in the new 10-year agreement, excuse me, as well the concept of a run size buffer. Both of those have turned out to be very important to the tribal interests, and so a key part of the entire package that we're agreeing to. The catch balancing does affect both upriver and downriver interests equally. Again, as far as we've been able to dig in, there's been some concern expressed from upriver interests that this also has worked to their detriment. We can't find any basis for that. It looks like so far it's been affecting both equally, but we will continue to dig a little further into that. These have been in practice over the last 10 years of the USV Oregon Agreement and through the last 5 years of the Commission policy. These have been the primary limiting factor for non-treaty fisheries, often more so even than the ESA impacts that underlie them. And that's largely testament to the effectiveness of the marked selective fisheries that we've been employing in the non-treaty, both in the recreational and commercial portions of the non-treaty sector, that we are so effective at using our ESA impacts that we can generally harvest more than the tribes can fishing non-selectively, with somewhat larger impacts allocated to them as well. So it's a very interesting situation and a real testament to the power of selective fisheries. From our standpoint as a salmon recovery agency, obviously that's not a bad thing to leave some ESA impacts in the water and contribute to salmon recovery, particularly for Upper Columbia Springs, which are admittedly still struggling, not showing the same signs of recovery that Snake River fish are. So before we dive in a little more deeply into some portions of this, just some quick orientation again to the basin geography. The three dams that are shown here are the three dams that are most often sort of the dividing line between upriver, downriver interests as we talk about them. Bonneville Dam, as I mentioned, for Spring Chinook. McNary Dam, which is the uppermost of the four lower dams, that's the last dam that both Snake River and Upper Columbia fish pass equally. You can see the Snake then going off to the right there, and then the Upper Columbia continuing up with the Yakima going off to the side. Priest Rapids Dam then is kind of the gateway to the Upper Columbia, and the tributaries upstream of there. So the fishing zones that I've been referring to already. Again, you can see that middle set of arrows being roughly the Zone 6 area that is also shared with the treaty tribes, and then the Snake off to the east, as well as the Lower Columbia fisheries. You can see that the Lower Columbia fisheries encompass also several, well, at least one primary tributary that's an Oregon tributary, the Willamette, that contributes a substantial amount of spring chinook to the lower river fishery, as well as the Cowlitz, the Lewis, and then doesn't show the Kalama, but combined, those three also contribute a large number of spring Chinook that simply aren't available to the other fisheries. So a lot of the catch numbers I'm going to be showing you in the next couple slides, those are omitted because they're really not subject to any of those sharing provisions because they're not going to pass Bonneville Dam. But when people talk about the inequity in catches, the first thing to ask them is, do your numbers below Bonneville include or exclude the lower river tributaries? Because those really dramatically increase. Again, you were well aware of this when you made your decisions about the previous policy, and part of the reason you allocated as many fish as you did to the lower river was to ensure that both Washington fishermen had access using Washington license to Willamette River fish, as well as obviously Oregon's interest in the 75-25 was similar, that Oregon fishers had access using Oregon licenses in the main stem to the Cowlitz, Clam, and Lewis fish. So part of the dynamic there. Again, as you move upriver, particularly before you get to Priest or before you get into the actual snake, there are some other major sources of spring production that are starting to drop out. The Klickitat, Deschutes, John Day, and Yakima also contribute a lot of fish to the main stem. So as you move upriver, and I think you all know this well, but it bears repeating, as you move upriver, you sort of get more and more distilled runs. In other words, many fewer harvestable fish per the same level of ESA impact. Doesn't mean you shouldn't go ahead and offer as broad a geographic range of fishing as possible, but this is one of the factors that's working against us as we try to achieve that. So this table that is now based, this is showing you in terms of actual harvest. And remember I said the real metric of sharing is actually the ESA impact and not the harvest. This is then just distilled to the upriver numbers only caught in each of the zones. So this isn't showing you the total picture. Obviously, we'll be prepared to, as we dive down into this, in order to give you some context in future, we'll show you this both ways. But you can get a sense that, and again, we don't have 2017 in here. It's too soon to have those numbers cranked and ready. So in order to give you 5 years, we showed 1 year before the policy takes effect. But as you can see, we're already sort of managing this way. So the harvest itself has averaged 77% below Bonneville of upriver fish. The impact, when you look at the impact, it's a little closer to the 75-25. It's actually 76% on impacts, and I don't have the impact version here to show you. Where there's the somewhat larger discrepancy is the upriver portion, that the 24% of impacts, 12% has occurred in Zone 6 and 12% in up in the snake. The targets are 10 and 15. What this also, though, doesn't display, I'm showing here the actual achieved catches, and really you've got to measure this based on opportunity. Was the opportunity for 25% upstream of Bonneville available every year? That's a lot harder for us to recreate. We will, though, put some work into trying to do that as we take a harder look at this. The catches are pretty easy to show, but in many cases, because, again, this is ESA-based management, and because we have very strict requirements in USV Oregon in terms of catch balancing, if we err, we're going to err on the side of coming up short. That's just a very basic principle. And what that often means is that we will close it down, particularly if we're closing it down on the rising tide of a fishery. You got to cut it even a little shorter in order to make sure you don't have a significant oops, because as you get towards the middle of a fishery, any one day can not just put you over a little bit, it can put you over a lot at times if conditions get right. So what that usually means is that allows us to transfer opportunity upriver. Doesn't mean they can always take it, though. Fishing conditions can go bad, fish can go off the bite, etc. But the real measure of how well this is working is, were the fish there to be caught, to get your actual percentage. And as I say, that's a lot harder to, opportunity is in the eye of the beholder, real catch is real catch. So that's what we're showing you here today. We will try and, though, go back. So again, some questions to ask when folks are sort of pushing at you about how well this is working or not is, well, did you have the opportunity? I recognize your catch came up short, but is that because downriver fish took them all? Sometimes in a couple of years, indeed that has been, and actually forestalled some opportunity. But or is it because fishing conditions?
Bill, Commissioner Baker would like to ask a question.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt, but the numbers on this slide are pretty interesting. And can you tell us what happened? Oh, wait.
The previous slide.
Can you go back?
I bounced too. I was gesticulating the wrong way.
What happened between 2013 and 2014 to skew the numbers like that? Do you know?
A lot of that was run size difference. We just had a fairly poor return in 2013. And Don, you may have some memory of this too. My sense is, though, that when we get those sudden drops in run size, we often overforecast, and I think this was partly a forecast error one. And even though we were managing that year with the buffer in place, the buffer may not have been sufficient. I will go back and dig on that, though. But I'm pretty sure that that was part of it. Checking to see if Commissioner McIsaac remembers that one.
I don't recall specifically, but I would bet.
So, but this is certainly what can happen when the run size drops an unexpectedly large amount, when we simply haven't caught it with the forecast, and even with a 30% buffer, you can still.
Yeah, right. Like he says, when we have.
If I may comment, back in that era, prior to say 2013 or up roughly in that era. We had a lot of difficulty with our forecasts. They were quite frequently in error. But it seems in recent years they've become much, much more accurate. And I'm speaking particular to spring salmon. Mm-hmm. It seems like whatever's being done, whether it's through modeling or whatever the methodology has changed, it's very apparent that they're much more accurate than they were 5 to 10 years ago.
And we'll continue to work at developing that. In particular, we're continuing to work to incorporate more and more ocean survival information. We're getting a lot more detailed information from our partners at National Marine Fisheries Service about they're doing annual field work now in the zone of the early marine life history stage. And we know that's often where a lot of the initial mortality occurs. So that's certainly helping. It does seem as if the environment's changing as fast as our ability to understand it is changing, too. So we'll see how that... I don't want to get cocky. So then let me quickly move on to some of the other species, again, just to give you some context of how we've done with recreational fishery management. Summer Chinook, we use the same dividing lines, but the focus here is on the summer Chinook returns to the upper Columbia, which are healthy and substantial. This is an unlisted stock. It's a stock that really struggled through the 80s and 90s. We kept main stem fisheries closed for over two decades on this stock as we worked hard to rebuild it, and the rebuilding measures included both a lot of work with supplementation, but as importantly, a lot of work to improve passage conditions, both through the five PUD dams of the upper Columbia as well as the four federal dams in the lower Columbia, and those all combined to give us large returns once ocean productivity returned right around the end of the 90s in 2000. And since then, we've had fairly healthy fisheries on those shared upriver and downriver. Here's a sense of the how that's worked out in terms of the sport harvest. As you can see, pretty comparable numbers above Priest with below Bonneville. They tend not to get caught a lot in the intervening areas. This is one where we've been able to fairly, and we're now using the dividing line at Priest, so well upstream of Bonneville, and where we normally, where we divide Spring Chinook. You can see we've essentially achieved 50-50 sharing, and that's been the objective, is to evenly share. Part of the reason for that is we're also trying to provide enough of a summer Chinook run size upstream of Priest that there's room for sharing with the Colville tribes, too, and their fisheries as well. But the certainly the Upper Columbia has really benefited. This is essentially not a brand new fishery, because long ago, well before the 80s, back actually in the early 70s, there was some fishing for summer Chinook upriver, but I think to nowhere nearly the extent that it is now. It's really blossomed as a real economic development opportunity for a lot of those upriver communities, and it's a fun fishery. And then just slightly broader context on that, you can see how this works out in terms of once you add in the Colville tribal percentage as well. This has been meeting their needs. I don't know if these kinds of numbers will continue, though, to meet their needs. That's going to be a subject of ongoing discussion with the Colvilles, particularly as the returns from the Colville hatchery begin to really kick in. And this table really doesn't capture much of that, those returns, even though we've been seeing them now for a couple of years. We expect the future to look a little more different than the past. Sockeye, again, another one that we've really been able to put a lot of recreational opportunity upstream of Priest Rapids for sockeye, both on the Wenatchee fishery, Lake Wenatchee fishery, which is fishery we've had for quite a while, but also with all the enhancement work that's gone on in the Okanagan, particularly in the Canadian portion of the Okanagan, that's really allowed us to develop a thriving sockeye recreational fishery around the mouth of the Okanagan and even into the river as well. We've had a lot of partners in that work to restore that run. It's pretty amazing to me that we've been able to restore the kinds of runs to the Okanagan above 9 dams, and it's a warm water river. To be able to achieve these kinds of runs, these kinds of returns, particularly with the Fraser tanking, is who knows if we'll be able to keep it up, but at the moment it's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, thank you. Just a comment too on that. I can't remember how many years ago, maybe 4 years ago, Canada actually had purse seines catching fish in the Soyuz Lake. There were just so many fish available.
Yeah.
I mean, it was incredible, the escapement.
And the importance of those returns, both the summer Chinook and the sockeye returns, to the tribes on both sides of the border cannot be overstated either. These are tribes that were essentially denied access to salmon for decades after the construction of first of Cooley and then of Chief Joe. The Colville tribes in their fisheries, the First Nations tribes in their fisheries, they have been taken not only for their own needs, but also for the needs of the other tribes and bands in that area that's simply been completely blocked. So it's a pretty extraordinary story. Fall Chinook. Here, the sharing picture is a little different because the dividing lines are slightly different as well. Buoy 10, it's obviously a fishery important, separate from the rest of the lower river. Then the stretch from Bonneville to McNairy. What this doesn't do is also call out the extensive Fall Chinook fisheries in the lower Snake as well. And we focus, though, a lot of our Fall Chinook management focuses around the what we call the upriver bright. And that's largely the Hanford Reach natural spawners. It does include some other populations. It includes the listed component of the Snake River. It also includes some of the Yakima production, as well as some production out of a couple of hatcheries and the major mitigation facility at Priest Rapids Dam, operated by Grant PUD, are all part of the Upriver Bright. But still, the heart of this, the vast majority of this, are the natural spawners out of the Hanford Reach that have been extremely productive, particularly through this last ocean cycle. Again, how whether it'll continue at the same strength is unknown, but we've been seeing natural escapements into that region of well over 100,000 per year now for over a decade consecutively. Our actual minimal escapement goal for there is 35 or 38,000, so as you can tell, we've been exceeding it. But in an area like that, those extra spawners aren't wasted at all. They're using up a lot of that productive stretch of the river. So the Hanford Reach fishery is a fishery that really has taken off in the last decade, so this doesn't fully capture it. But a decade ago, it was limited to a few kind of diehard local fishermen. It's turned into a destination fishery. Consequently, we've actually developed an escapement-based plan for it, and we do in-season management of it now. That was unheard of 10 years ago. So that's a recreational opportunity that's just really come at us in the last 10 years that we've been able to accommodate, again, largely due to the combination of the very productive returns that we've been seeing now for quite a while, as well as the fact that these are commingled with the ESA-listed fall chinook out of the Snake River, and so that has really constrained harvest downstream of the Snake River mouth. So that alone assures large numbers back to the Hanford Reach. But you can see that, in general, we've been able to provide a lot of actual harvest upstream of McNary, even with some pretty healthy harvests in Buoy 10. Upriver Brights don't actually hit that well in the stretch between Buoy 10 and Bonneville. These large numbers are just a reflection of the very large amount of fishing effort. But it's actually fairly hard to catch them, but it gives you just a sense of the overall magnitude and importance of that lower river fishery during the fall. You've got summer steelhead moving, you've got chinook moving, both tulies and brights, and you've got the beginnings of the coho showing up. And so there's just a ton of fishing effort out there. They catch a fair number. But as you can see, they're pretty. Catch itself is pretty broadly distributed throughout the basin for fall chinook, with a lot of upriver opportunity as well. So, again, just a sense of overall the, and here's a summary slide on that. Again, just to give you a sense of how things break out. With any individual species, the pictures differ pretty dramatically, but when you try to put all this together and think about essentially fishing opportunity across the year, you can see that we've actually, overall, I think, doing a pretty good job of achieving broad geographic distribution of recreational fishing throughout the basin. And then I did add in one for steelhead. The picture on steelhead is so much more complicated, we didn't want to try to dive into it in terms of numeric, but again, just to help round out the picture, I mean, again, even what's called fall for steelhead is different than everything else. So it's this isn't comparably put together with the other four, so it's not, we're not showing on the same thing, but just a sense as well that we are achieving a lot of harvest distribution. This also doesn't include any of the massive Idaho steelhead fisheries, which are certainly part of the larger suite. This also does not include any of the Upper Columbia tributary steelhead catches, because those are managed on an entirely different biological opinion under a different basis, but we can't always consistently offer Upper Columbia steelhead opportunity, but when we can, that's been an important part of this picture too. So that's my overview kind of view of how the first 5 years have worked relative to that. Let me focus in some then on some of the concerns that we've heard voiced recently, primarily from Southeast Washington. Their letters voiced several different concerns. First off, even though the commission tried to provide clear opportunity for both, their concern has been that both how we manage as well as the structure of our managements continue to from their perspective, they continue to favor downriver opportunity, and that they recognize that any favoring of downriver opportunity comes at the expense of upriver opportunity. They pointed to some fairly specific framework issues, and those are, as I've said already, I don't think those, we haven't been able to validate any of those concerns. We haven't been able to document any validity to any of the specific concerns. The other point they make is just how we as an agency structure our management and how we house our managers, largely out of Region 5, also sort of adds to the appearance that it favors downriver management. They do make the point that the Commission's basic choice of 75-25 is disproportionate from their perspective, that it does not align well with the actual residence patterns of the anglers. And for that, they point to the location of the sales of the Columbia River endorsement and argue that a policy should more closely align with residents. That's obviously, you all, I think, considered allocation patterns like that and decided not to do that. But that's an issue that they continue to believe should be discussed. They point out as well that this kind of disproportionate sharing does not incentivize salmon recovery activities. They remind you in the letter that many of the salmon recovery activities that have been so successful over the last several decades have been both from the Upper Columbia and from the Snake watershed, and there's been a huge level of citizen engagement. And just a reminder that salmon fishing is one of those things. Having good, meaningful salmon fishing opportunity is one of those things that incentivizes citizens to continue to do the hard work of salmon recovery. It's often fairly thankless work, getting the permits, working with the local authorities, trying to change land use patterns, et cetera. And as well, the argument that that's resulted in large economic investments in recovery, and that an argument that those investments should be considered when you're considering the economic benefits that you spread around through how you allocate recreational fishing. And then finally, there's a sort of an ongoing sense that much of their input in the past has not really been meaningful, just in the way that public input has been structured, and a request that we sort of double down on our efforts to incorporate meaningful public input. One of the factors they pointed to is that when they meet just with Washington, there's a sense that, well, the other 50% of the decision isn't even in the room, the Oregon managers, and a request that future public input sessions recognize that factor and find a way of accommodating so that they have a sense that they're talking to all the managers of the non-treaty share when they're talking to us. So those were their concerns. We have responded to this.
Mr. Kehoe has a question.
Can you back up, Bill?
I can.
Second to last bullet, the disproportionate sharing does not incentivize salmon recovery. Is that specific to the spring Chinook?
I think yes, they were couching it specific to spring Chinook. I would be very surprised, though, if you were to ask them that they would say it's spring Chinook only. I'd be very surprised if they would respond that way. I'm pretty sure they would say, no, that's across all the listed or all the species needing recovery work, okay. So steelhead, et cetera. The other thing I meant to mention in this context as well, very recently, we heard from the state of Idaho at a USV Oregon meeting, they have labeled the 2017 spring Chinook management as a failure of downriver management and pointed out that 7 of the 13 Idaho spring Chinook hatcheries are not likely to meet their escapement goals this year. Still too soon to tell whether that's correct or not, but based on pit tags, they usually have a pretty good idea of how they'll do. So I think you can expect to hear more as well, kind of along the same lines from the state of Idaho.
Bill, I'd like to just talk a little bit about that bullet as well. Both Dave and you alluded to the top-down piece, and I've been struck that those who are involved with the terminal fisheries really bear the brunt of, especially with our listed species, the protection activities. So recognizing how to incentivize that with opportunity seems really important to me. And I don't expect you to answer it now, but at some point I'd be real interested in staff perspective on that and how we as a commission developing policy might take that into consideration, if it makes sense to take it into consideration.
Thanks, Madam Chair. We can, as part of our next steps, try to put some thought and maybe bring some options forward for different ways of potentially trying to incorporate that. Happy to take that on, I think.
Onward.
Yeah. So the response that was signed by both the director and Commission Chair Smith to these letters had several points, but there's two that I want to highlight for you here today. One is agency commitment to initiate a five-year review once the 2017 data are sort of fully in of this upriver, downriver allocation section, and engage the Southeast Washington counties in particular in the design of that review process so that they feel like the review process is really structured to for them to have meaningful public input. And then secondly, they also sort of, a couple points, labeled the current 75-25 as arbitrary, and I didn't really flag that. But the letter used that term. And so we tried to include sort of a sense that, no, this was not arbitrary. This was a thought-out commission decision, and that commission was balancing a couple of competing objectives here, and tried to provide just a sort of an example table of that. And those two competing objectives are, first off, just maximizing the Washington recreational harvest. That's always a good idea, from a statewide perspective. Maximize the amount of recreational benefit you have out of what you're given to work with at any given time. The competing objective is the diversity, achieving a diversity of recreational opportunities. And so what we did was we constructed a little sort of hypothetical table showing how those two interplay across three fairly different allocations. If, for instance, you were to completely just put all of your emphasis on maximizing total Washington recreational harvest, a strategy might be to put 100% of your spring Chinook recreational harvest opportunity below Bonneville, and essentially none elsewhere. That would provide the highest overall recreational harvest. Obviously, in reality, you wouldn't quite do that. You'd feather it a little bit, but this is just a generalized version. This provides the greatest access to all the upstream runs. We know the fishing power is there below Bonneville, and provides the greatest access to returns to both the Oregon and Washington tributaries as well. But obviously, it provides essentially zero diversity. Whereas if you were to go roughly 50-50, out of that, you'd have the lowest overall catch, because you'd have moved over half your fishery to areas upstream of some of those large runs in the lower river, and away from a lot of your overall recreational fishing power into other areas. But you'd achieve the highest level of geographic diversity. You probably couldn't go much higher than that in terms of achieving recreational diversity, even if you went to more than 50% upstream of Bonneville. And then 75-25, right in the middle, gives you a median harvest, still addresses that, but does a much better job than 100-0 of addressing geographic diversity. So just a sense of, and again, this wasn't why you chose 75-25 in particular, it just so happens that it's halfway in between 50-50 and 100-0, but just gives us, hopefully, gives folks a sense of this is a way of balancing, and this is an approach to balancing, and a sense that your decision was really your attempt to find an inflection point Obviously, you were also thinking about a lot more variables. You were thinking about other species. You were thinking about recreational commercial sharing as well. You're thinking about how this fits into both ESA and USV Oregon contexts. So there are quite a few more. But just as sort of a simplified version, really focused on recreational fishing, just to try to give a sense of every decision you make in this arena is going to be a trade-off between a couple different objectives, and usually they are, to some extent, competing objectives. So we have not yet begun conversation with those counties. We intend to kick that off in the next month or so and try to begin to structure some things. We'll be happy to provide you with updates as that proceeds. We haven't received a response to them from them to our response, and again, happy to share those as those come in. So with that, I'd like to switch gears a little bit and focus in on the Upper Columbia Fishery Management Plan, which certainly will be a part of a larger review of upper river, downriver, both spring chinook, but potentially other species too. This, as Commissioner Graybill already referenced, this plan was drafted and with a lot of review by stakeholders back in 2005-2006. Most of the public input was from 2006. The intent by the department in developing the plan was to provide a companion document to the allocation agreement that we were signing with the Colvilles and that we did sign in 2007 that allocates a portion of the non-treaty share to the Colville fisheries back to their reservation waters for their harvest opportunity there. And so this was intended to kind of put the larger Upper Columbia context in place, but also, as Commissioner Graybill referenced, it was really kind of filling in a missing link. As we were restoring fisheries up there, there wasn't a clear sense of how some of our fishing opportunity up there related first to escapement and the basic conservation objectives, but then also how it fit into the larger context of the Columbia. Even though it has always been a draft, we have actually been implementing it, primarily Region 2 staff, because it's almost largely contained within Region 2, have been implementing it in draft form since 2007. It does provide for each species up there, provides abundance-based management criteria for the fisheries upstream of Priest Rapids and covers both the Columbia main stem and the tributaries up there. Entirely consistent with our ESA objectives up there. We've worked with both NIMS and the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board to ensure that. but it's 10 years old, and we've learned a lot. We've learned, for instance, that we didn't envision how big sockeye runs could get, but we've also learned a fair amount about how we use steelhead fisheries to remove hatchery fish, et cetera. So it does need review and updating, as Commissioner said. And so it's, I think, something we'll be having to work at over the next year or two. And I don't see how we take on this larger task without also, to some extent, taking that on at the same time. But we haven't really scoped that out fully with regional staff yet who are necessary for that, et cetera.
Bill, what about the allocation agreement with the Colville tribes? Is that into perpetuity, or is that something that needs to be looked at now with their hatchery coming online fully?
We did try to anticipate the hatchery, but it has also proven a little short-sighted in terms of sockeye, and they're interested as well. So we're probably going to need to review and update that at the same time. Thank you for reminding me of that.
Yes, that's an excellent question because I've recently received their spring Chinook releases were much more substantial than I realized. And I think that's relatively new information. For example, when we were talking to the state of Oregon during the Columbia River policy, they were unaware of spring salmon releases, and in fact, at that time, I only understood that there were 200,000 being released when it's actually in excess of 700,000. So that's kind of new information that needs to be incorporated into what we're going to review and update.
Thanks.
And while I had your ear, I thought it was worthwhile just to give you a little sense of how we're doing some reorganizing within the fish program. relative to both Columbia River Fishery Management, but also Columbia River Hydro Management, and how we'll sort of work Fish Program Olympia in concert with the regions. And so just give you, and I'm really, really apologize for the lime green on white, which doesn't show at all well.
White on red next time, please.
But in essence, this box is me. Excuse me. I can't even read my own writing well. This box is Ron Warren, head of Fish Program. This box is me leading up a new unit that has three sections to it. One section is the group that where we've pulled the position that Ron Roller has retired from recently. That position has been in the director's office, and then also pulled me out of the director's office. And this position, along with much of the technical support for this position, which had been in Region 5, were pulled together into a single unit. And so, and one of the main tasks for this unit, in addition to all the regular tasks that you're all aware of, like supporting our USV Oregon work, supporting Columbia River Compact, supporting North of Falcon, supporting management of the fisheries below Bonneville, one of the other tasks will be to pull together a Columbia Basin management group that will consist of some portion of the staff from each of the other regions in the Columbia Basin and hold, you know, essentially regular coordination calls so that regulations as they go out will have been coordinated across all the regions. We've had, and for often for very good reason, but difficult to explain, we've had occasions where, for instance, at the same time that we're closing sockeye in the upper Columbia, we're opening sockeye below Bonneville. There's usually a pretty good reason for it, but they're region-specific reasons. They're not sort of that kind of step back, and so it's often difficult, if not impossible, to explain to ourselves, much less stakeholders and others. And so our hope is to minimize those kinds of flybys because, you know, in that one, there was no conservation impact. It wasn't even really an allocation impact, but it just doesn't make sense. But it also raises the possibility of doing this and having an allocation, or even worse, doing this and having an inadvertent conservation impact. So we want to make sure that we reduce the chances of that to essentially zero. So that's another part of the function of that unit. The middle box here is the existing sturgeon smelt pike minnow unit, and that unit has already been working across regional boundaries, even though they're headquartered out of Vancouver, and they'll continue to be headquartered out of Vancouver. But smelt is largely below Bonneville, but certainly pike minnow control and sturgeon issues are broader than that. So the regions continue to have their own sturgeon expertise and program, but this group provides a lot of the support for that, a lot of the technical support for that. And then finally, this box over here is our small hydro group. They've been working out of the Yakima region, and we're going to pull them in too, partly to ensure just that we're thinking across all the ages, particularly as you do harvest. There's a lot of parallels, a lot of similarities between in-season management of hydro to ensure fish passage is optimized at the same time we're the hydro system's grappling with everything else they're grappling with. There's a lot of similarities between that kind of in-season management and in-season management of harvest. And there should be similar principles as well, but also in the pre-season planning too. Many of the tools they use to measure the success of passage are also tools that we can use to measure productivity and survival for run size forecasting and for in-season tracking for harvest purposes also. So to make sure we're using the same tools consistently too. So the idea is to give us sort of a more rounded, more all-age unit addressing Columbia River, primarily harvest and hydro issues, but obviously hatchery and habitat flowed in and out too. So pretty excited about that. Still getting that up and running, working through all the personnel challenges and everything else, but that should be in place for as we tackle 2018. So in summary, First off, about the Spring Chinook Recreational Fishery. On our first look, and again, I want to emphasize that the first look hasn't really included opportunity and is primarily focused on catch, not ESA impacts. But on first look, the above Bonneville has come up a little short on overall harvest, a little closer on ESA impacts, but still slightly below. There are the occasional years where it's much more disproportionate, as Commissioner Baker noted in her question. So there's obviously more to look at there, particularly, though, going back and also looking at opportunity and seeing how it shakes out that way. The concerns that the run size buffer and catch balancing have been working to the detriment of the upriver, we can't support those, we can't validate those. But again, we can take a somewhat deeper look there to see if maybe there's still something we can do better. Overall, when you look across all the species, we have been really successful at providing a broad range of recreational fishing opportunities throughout the basin over the last 5 years. There's a really good track record there. That does provide a lot of balance across the species. We get that spring Chinook sort of stands out and deserves even more consideration, but don't lose track of the other species. But in general, if you just look at three of the five stocks, there is actually more harvest upriver than downriver. Gave you an overview of what the stakeholder concerns are that we've been hearing, as well as what our first response is, and there is some work involved in that. That five-year review is going to take staff time, take staff effort. Ultimately, you'll probably have to consider some of the results of that and think about what you want to do with that. Similarly, we've got some staff work ahead of us with Upper Columbia Fish Management Plan, and again, depending upon your druthers, that may or may not end up back for you to take another look at as well. So with that, happy to take any questions.
Commissioners? Commissioner Graybill.
Just a comment. Bill, this is a very thorough, very informative presentation. It certainly met my request in terms of being able to brief the commission. I wanted us all to be able to start off with good solid information, so as we move forward, we have a good basis for that. I was also very encouraged to see the restructuring that you mentioned, because I think that has the potential alleviating a lot of the tension between upriver and downriver. As you mentioned, the sockeye closure and openers were one of the most recent examples of that. I really appreciate your sensitivity to that. And I know we're looking at a body of work here, and this is going to take a period of time. It's not going to be done by next spring salmon season, that just shows you how naive I am about this process. But I really appreciate your presentation, the indulgence of the commission as we move forward with this process, and I look forward to some updates, and we'll roll up our sleeves and see if we can do a better job on the Columbia River as an entirety for both recreation and commercial fishing considerations. Thank you, Bill.
I've got a couple commissioners. Commissioner Baker?
Well, representing the kind of newish people on here, I also really appreciate this. Fish policy is, I used to think health policy was Byzantine, and I had never run into anything like this. But the other thing I really appreciate is you starting with conservation, because that's sort of my highest priority and why I want it on this commission. And with that comes a question, which is, I see those buffers as being quite a good conservation tool. And I just wonder, do the tribes and the First Nations, if we were to see their analog of this presentation, do they do the same thing with buffers?
Not the same thing. We all manage our fisheries in a precautionary approach so that we don't exceed our ESA take limits. And those are our most basic standard of conservation, because all the analyses that went into those limits were all based on the all-H approach, that if you know, essentially, if you achieve this amount of survival through the hydro system, if you take these kinds of actions in hatcheries, both to supplement but also to minimize risks that hatcheries pose, if you achieve these kinds of gains in habitat productivity, and you have you limit harvest impacts on ESA-listed fish to this, are you on a recovery trajectory? And in each case, the answer to that was yes. And so as we view conservation in terms of our annual harvest work, it's first and foremost, it's defined as, did you stay below your ESA take objective? And that's your annual part of your annual contribution towards achieving recovery for ESA-listed stocks. For the other stocks that aren't ESA-listed, it's a simpler, just did you avoid fishing into escapement? And again, just largely because of, even if it's an unlisted stock, usually there's ESA constraints at one end or the other or something. And so all of our harvest in the Columbia Basin has achieved either ESA goals or escapement objectives now for, gosh, 20-plus years. So that precautionary approach is all the way through. The First Nations harvest in particular is so limited that they've stayed well below initially. The reason they don't have a buffer on their run size is, as they like to say, because they're fishing on real fish. All the tribal fisheries, except a very minimal amount, are above Bonneville, and so they're based on updates of the run size as verified by how fish have passed Bonneville, our actual counts of fish past Bonneville. Whereas so many of our fisheries are below Bonneville that they're fishing to a large extent on the forecast. So that's the reason for that being applied largely to the non-treaty fisheries below Bonneville.
Thank you. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Madam Vice or Madam Chair. And I'd also like to say thanks to Bill for just an outstanding presentation. Another great piece of work that you've done here. Excellent slides and bringing in these other pieces of information to what was labeled as a spring Chinook review is very helpful. I have two questions that try to get to my understanding more about when the commission would weigh in a policy context as there might be changes considered. So the two questions are, does C-3620 sunset in 20 years? And the second question is the quote of after the run size update, there's a priority for upriver fisheries. Does the state of Oregon agree with that commission statement? And again, these questions are trying to get a better understanding as the department has committed to start the review. This may be the kickoff point here. And as we move toward 5 years from now, all these other things in play, the Columbia River water policy business, the U.S. v. Oregon renegotiations, and all the rest. And there are periodic times when it might come back before the commission for some policy decision-making. If nothing happens, does it sunset in 5 years? And how does Oregon check into this?
So, yes, it does expire in 2023. Oregon has doesn't receive the same level of benefits out of this guidance on after the run size update as Washington does. There's far more Washington upriver fisheries that benefit from that than Oregon fisheries. And so of their own, Oregon would balance this a little differently. But in order to have as much concurrent two-state guidance as possible, on this larger policy, Oregon staff have agreed and worked with this, but they do remind us that it's largely benefits Washington fisheries when they as they work with us. But they have been cooperative sometimes because simply the horses are out of the barn already. I mean, and it doesn't make any sense not to do this. But in other years, it has actually been to some extent to Oregon's benefit, detriment. as measured strictly through their own perspective.
Yes, sure.
So as we move through the next 5 years, perhaps the gentleman to my left is looking for something before the end of 5 years. So when would be an appropriate time for the commission to consider policy choices, in your opinion, I guess, for an organized approach that considers all these other factors?
I would guess that we're bringing in some new staff, reorganizing the unit. All that's going to take a little bit of time. We've got the 2018 planning looming already, and then the additional work of both reviewing the Upper Columbia plan, but also working with the Southeast Washington concerns to structure that process. As I think about all those things, I'd be surprised if we'd be ready to bring you anything in less than a year. So maybe September, October of 2018 might be a time frame for you to think about. Obviously, if you want to put the whip to the horses, I'm sure Joe Storr is ready to hear you on that. But it seems to me, particularly, again, I want to emphasize, we've had a lot of key retirements. We're biting off a lot ahead of us. It's hard for me to see that we could bring you a really quality product before then. And it might take longer.
Yes, Commissioner Grable.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that will be coming up, I don't have a problem with the deadline that you described. I think it's reasonable given the scope of work that's going to be required. I know that my constituents won't be happy with that, but I think that's a very real appraisal. 2019, we will be reviewing the Columbia River policy, certain elements of it. No, we're not going to open up the entire policy, and I believe it's focused, Commissioner Kehoe, on zones 4 and 5 fishery for review primarily is when we reconvene on that, if I recall it correctly. But that's the only element that I see that the next sort of Washington-Oregon deadline that we face. But you're absolutely right about we'll need to consult with Oregon on this as we move ahead, I'm sure. And one of the things that I learned through the process of the Washington-Oregon talks on the Columbia River policy was all their maps and models ended at McNary Dam. And so you're absolutely right that to remind them of the considerations and that our responsibility on the Columbia River to the Canadian border, and they do not end at the border of Washington and Oregon.
Yeah. And to that end, Commissioner, you reminded me, I did have a conversation before we sent the letter from the director and Commission Chair Smith to the Southeast Washington, our response letter. I did have a conversation with Oregon and just said, this is how we're thinking about responding. Are you willing to work with us? And I got both a heavy sigh, but also a yes. We recognize that.
Okay.
And the heavy sigh was just, it's workload.
They
get that it's difficult to have, it's difficult for us to go quite a ways with our constituents without them in the room. Puts them in an awkward spot of having to essentially be the bad guy in a way, and that's not an okay place. That's not a good partnership.
Yeah. Understood.
Any other questions, commissioners? Well, again, thank you, and I think we're all very pleased to see you in this position. So.
Yeah, we can ask you about North Pacific issues
too. Yeah,
you can.
Right.
I'm still doing North Pacific, much to my great pleasure. And it's so. I'm also still the invasive species guy.
Great.
Sorry.
The guy who can do it. That's wonderful. Thank